and not getting towed, and everybody knows that that's somebody staying there, and it's, I have not yet had any complaints about that. I don't know if you have, but I remember that there was a lot of neighborhood opposition. It was kind of like doing the accessory dwelling unit study, that when we found out how many there were and that most of us didn't know where they were in our neighborhoods, that was what allowed us to say this could be accommodated. So I just wanted to like get that out to neighborhoods that, in fact, we know of this is happening already.
I appreciate that, Commissioner, and I agree with that. We haven't heard any complaints from anyone, actually, for quite a long time about those that have been located on parking lots. So we're full of hope for that as well. And, you know, frankly, I think we as a city are at a different place than we were then. I mean, the work that Commissioner Fish did was groundbreaking and ahead of the visibility of the problem. And just based on the conversation I had with the directors and chairs and the work group that they've created, there is a much deeper sense of realism in the conversations now that we have to figure out ways of accommodating our homeless Portlanders. The fourth option that we have to offer people is shelter. We've already started that discussion clearly, and I'll have George Devendorf again come up and discuss the specifics of the shelters that we have. But I also think that the shelter that the mayor mentioned in San Francisco is something that we're interested in also trying to replicate moving forward, because it is a different kind of shelter. And kind of, you know, as all of this is moving forward, there is innovation on all of the fronts all over the country. And so we've been trying to inform ourselves on what those are and figure out the good ones and bring them back here. So that would be one. So again, four options that we have to offer people, with the theory being that if someone chooses none of those options, that then is an opportunity for us, either an opportunity to bring in higher barrier service through programs like our high intensity street engagement program, or when appropriate, to use enforcement. So I want to be very clear that this plan does not stop sweeps, and in fact, in some ways may actually bring more of them. But the design of this is to strategically use them when appropriate and for people who truly need it, rather than the blanket approach that we've been using for quite a long time. So these four options we think will start to get us there. And again, the details are still being fleshed out on many of them, but now it's the time for both council and the community to help inform those discussions now that we've kind of created that framework. If it's okay, I'm going to keep moving because we have some folks who are also going to speak, one of whom, as I just mentioned, couldn't be here because she had an emergency, as happens in her world. But Shannon Singleton, the executive director of JOIN, did give me a comment to read into the record. So if you'll indulge me for a moment, I'll do that. And she said, "These guidelines are one tool and a step toward providing multiple safe sleeping options for our neighbors sleeping outside. Outreach workers are committed to helping people understand and follow the guidelines. We're confident that providing opportunity for people to sleep enables them to focus on their goal of moving back into housing. We look forward to working with a home for everyone in this council to implement multiple strategies for ensuring people have safe places to sleep, as well as the supports they need to end their homelessness."
Josh, we're a little past the hour. I feel the need to say every hour on the hour that nobody thinks that sleeping outside is a preferred option, and that there should be inside spaces for everybody. And so this is, again, people need to, there is a plan which needs to be funded, and we don't have the funding. So we've been getting a lot of emails about Portland can do better. Absolutely, we all agree Portland can do better, and everybody has a piece of it. So that's your public service announcement for this hour, and I'll do another one later.
Thank you, Commissioner. I did want to call up next Assistant Chief Bob Day, if he is still here. I saw him a little earlier. And Chief Day is going to talk about a police perspective to this set of policies.
Thank you, Josh. I'm Bob Day, Assistant Chief of the Operations Branch. Mr. Mayor, Commissioners. So a couple things. I want to recognize the mayor's support, but also specifically Josh and I have worked very closely on this effort over the last several weeks. And I've really been grateful for his willingness to accept our ideas and our input and to engage the police on this challenge, recognizing that to be so bold to say that I think our police officers have become our number one outreach workers. They're out there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I'm very proud of the challenges that they take on and the work that they do, particularly around this issue. These calls for service, these communities that we're now interacting with in public spaces, dominate the police officers' time. And it's not necessarily something that we've done a good job of training and preparing our members for, because we're a solution-based organization just by our culture. We like to fix things, and oftentimes we're encountering situations that just aren't fixable at the time that we're there, and they require a lot of cooperation with a lot of other agencies, city agencies, outreach organizations, et cetera. And I just want to applaud and recognize the men and women of the police bureau that are doing that on a daily basis with a passion and a compassion that is really impressive. And also, once again, thank Josh for including us in this process, this conversation. The effort around this that appeals to me is because it's an attempt to try and bring some clarity to a very, very, as I said earlier, confusing set of problems. And clarity both for the community at large, that includes our people that are sleeping outside, as well as outreach workers who we partner with, as I said earlier, very regularly, so they can have a consistent message, and of course the police, which are most highly visible when it comes to ongoing contact with members of the community. So, you know, our intent here, although I would not say that it's, you know, perfect by any means, both internally and externally, is to try and provide a message for our officers and for our leadership within the police bureau to be able to clearly explain, here's sort of the guidelines, here's what we're looking for, here's what you can tell people, because we encounter folks daily with, you know, very few options other than you just can't be here. So that's sort of our goal, and when Josh approached me with that mindset, that's something that I could get behind and say, yeah, I want to be a part of that. There's not, you know, 25 years ago, if you told me I'd be sitting here and we'd be talking about this issue, I'd say, no, I arrest bad guys, I'm into cops and robbers and all that. This is an issue that has now fallen to the feet of the police on a daily basis, and we need to be able to partner in that with everybody. Finally, I think we all do recognize that there is a public safety nexus here with this challenge, and that's not lost on me. I've spoken before this council before. I do believe there's a role for enforcement. I hope that some of this direction being led by the mayor's office will bring a little bit of clarity to that, but there is a role for enforcement. We do know that people living outside, as stated earlier, are vulnerable for a variety of reasons. We do know that there's a criminal element that will essentially use those communities as cover for that, for those acts of violence. And, you know, the police are very much engaged and desirous to prevent those and provide good public safety for everyone. So, overall, I'm willing to embark on this with Josh and the Police Bureau. I've asked several members of the command staff to be here with me today to hear this. It'll be a topic of discussion this week as we help our members navigate it.
So, Bob, you might comment a little bit. I know you've seen the draft of the of the guidelines and the card that Josh wants us to be able to hand people. I think the fundamental problem for our police officers has been if you're going to tell somebody you can't sleep there, you have to be able to finish the sentence, right? And so I think that the question is, you know, if we're able to tell people, here are the guidelines, you cannot camp in these kinds of places or in these kinds of ways, or you can't leave your tent up after 7 a.m., is that the kind of clarity that our folks need? And obviously you and I and everybody else will have to communicate that if it gets to that point. But I think there's been a lot of anxiety because we can't finish the sentence.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. You know, Josh and I have had a lot of conversations both with the city attorney and the district attorney. I want to make sure that we don't, you know, trump some existing policy or ordinance that we certainly want to maybe come back to and rely upon at a later date. I don't know what that would be. I don't see that at this time. But absolutely giving our members some options, because, I mean, the stories, and you're familiar with them, Eric, because you hear them and see them, but, you know, our officers encountering people, trying to problem solve, looking for options. Enforcement is not our go-to on this. And so, you know, my hope is that this allows us to bring something to the membership to be able to tell the community, here are some options.
Josh, I'm curious. Right now, based on conversation I've had with Chief Day, he gets calls for service that he can't respond to. And when we hit the night shift, if there's a serious hot spot somewhere in our city, we are very thin in terms of our force. So one of the, I think, questions we're going to have to anticipate is we're going to get a lot more contacts from the public dealing with relatively minor things, like it looks like this camp is getting too big, to specific things. I think I see someone engaging in illegal conduct. And we are always distinguishing between status issues and conduct issues. Let's be clear. But so who is responding, and where are who are people contacting in the first instance, and is it realistic to think that that the police bureau can do more? Now I happen to, when the first thing you said, Bob, was about the evolution of policing, and I've watched it. I mean, Mark first sort of opened my eyes to it, and I've watched it with your officers. They do fantastic work engaging people, and that was not once upon a time their primary role, but there's been a sea change, and I'm very proud of the way our officers interact with people who are vulnerable and problem solve. But I also want to calibrate the expectations. Are we creating a situation here that's going to be beyond your capacity to address?
Thanks, Commissioner. You're setting me up perfectly here, because the next portion of the work session is to talk about the initiatives that we've started, one of which is our one point of contact system. Now, we did a very soft launch of that about a month ago. It's being managed by William Warren in our facilities office and by Lucas Hillier, who works out of our office, and Lucas will come up to present in a little bit about it. But that was designed with several goals in mind, one of which was to truly be the receptacle for public comment other than 911 calls. Obviously, 911 calls should continue going to 911, but for the much lower level or atemporal concerns that people have, we needed a system where there was one point of contact where it could come in and then those folks could triage it. Now, a lot of those calls, and William Lucas will go through this when he does his presentation, get farmed out to our service providers for immediate triage from outreach workers or other experts in the field that shouldn't be particularly handled by police. So they act as kind of a way station, if you will, for all the calls that are coming in, the emails that are coming in. Lucas has numbers, he'll go through them with you, and really just even for a soft launch, I mean, the numbers I think are well over 300 now in about a month's time, and what you'll learn is that they're concentrated around 12 hotspots in the city. That data to us is invaluable, and we know that it's real because they're all coming into one particular place. So our goal is to get kind of a narrow chute that people can send all of that to, so that one, we can collect that data, two, we can respond quickly, and three, we can farm out where appropriate and unburden generally what are all the calls going right now into the police. Because as you said, most of those aren't actually police calls.
And Commissioner, I appreciate you recognizing that concern. Last year, calls around this particular issue for our community surpassed complaints as related to traffic. Historically, traffic complaints are the number one public safety concern communities far and wide. These calls for service surpass that. And so we're also internally, while we're addressing strategies around staffing issues, reviewing our own protocols in terms of calls for service and what we respond to, what we're able to manage. And finally, if along the lines of what Josh is proposing, if successful, I relate it a little bit to Lines for Life, and the example being that, you know, several people who call every day seeking for help while they're in crisis that the police never respond to. When they call 911, it's just automatically sent to the police within 30 to 60 seconds. But yet there's many people who work through very traumatic, difficult challenges throughout the day by just simply calling Lines for Life and being connected with the right person. So in the same regard here, if we can create both for the community and the consumer sort of the repository, for lack of a better term, a place where they can go to, then maybe that will divert some from the police as well. Commissioner?
Yeah, I actually had one question for Chief Day and then two for Josh. The question for you, Bob, is I was struck one day during communications, we had somebody from the homeless community come in to testify, and he said that in the sweeps don't distinguish between, these are his words, the peaceful hobos and the punks looking for trouble. And that struck me as, like, probably is that dichotomy, and it struck me that it might be difficult for the police in the moment to tell who's who. Do you think that having this plan in place will make it easier for the police to distinguish between the peaceful hobos and the punks looking for trouble?
The short answer would be I don't know. there's absolutely, like I said earlier, a criminal element that embeds itself into these groups of folks, and then, you know, use that as a cover. And really, that distinguishing comes through relationship building. It comes through time. You know, and I could bring up a multitude of officers. The other night we were in Brentwood, Darlington. There was officers there off duty on their own time. Meeting with Josh afterwards, talking about proposals that he had developed while working with members of the community that are sleeping outside. I mean, we have officers that are doing that work and do distinguish and are able to know the difference. One of the things that may help us with this is, I don't like putting a number on anything because it kind of puts you into a box a little bit, but Josh is talking, you know, about the number six. I mean, where we face this challenge predominantly is when it becomes really, you know, too large to distinguish. We show up over a period of time and you have 15, 20 people and et cetera. So possibly the smaller numbers might allow that.
And I'm not sure what the time is to ask this, I'm just going to ask it now, two bureau-y questions. One is that one problem that we've had with PBOD is we've been told that we have to send somebody out. I mean, there will continue to be sweeps. We've been told we have to continue to send somebody out during a sweep to sort of be the representative of the property owner to oversee the sweep. And that's a real drain on our resources. Given union contracts, et cetera, there's a very limited number of people who can do that. We wind up sending really high-paid people out to supervise the sweep, where there's not really, from our perspective, it doesn't seem like we're much more versus doing that. So we hope that you guys can take a look at whether that's really necessary. The other, that's more of a comment than a question. The bureau-related question is, to what extent have the infrastructure bureaus who have been asked to help with this plan by identifying locations, et cetera, been involved in this development, and how much future involvement do you think they will have?
Great question. And yes to the first one. One of the next steps out of many is to take a look at the actual practices of how we do those sweeps, because I've been in enough of the conversations with PBOT to know that that is a particular challenge there. So that's on our radar. To your second question, I've presented several times now to the Bureau Directors meeting and as recently as last week to walk through this system, and have had one-on-one conversations with many, if not all, I think many of the Bureau Directors who own land in the city. I've also discussed with them the opportunity for the mayor to look more favorably on budget proposals and the reduction of potential cuts with more land being put on the table for us to use in the short term. Because truly, a lot of the budget requests are built on the idea of having to go purchase land. And if we can prevent that for a temporary period of time, that's more helpful in the budget discussions as well. So I've tried to get that across to Bureau Directors as we move forward to have an option. Great. Thank you, Chief. And I wanted to call up just for one more person to weigh in on kind of the street management side before we move quickly through the street management initiatives. And that's Monica Garacki from the Oregon Law Center.
Okay. How's that? Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. I'm Monica Garacki, and I'm the managing attorney of the Oregon Law Center's Portland Regional Office. The Oregon Law Center is a statewide legal aid program that serves low-income Oregonians with civil legal needs. I've been working on legal issues related to homelessness in Portland since 2005, but the legal aid program's advocacy on this issue goes back well before my time to attorneys like Mark Jolin, Ron Rubino, Julie Stevens, Ed Johnson, Mickey Ryan, David Thornburg, and others. It's been a while since the Anderson litigation, which was filed in 2008 and settled in 2012. Two of you were here, along with Commissioner Saltzman, through our multiple rounds of settlement negotiations, in which the possibility of camping guidelines was repeatedly discussed and rejected. The Anderson settlement made some positive changes to Portland's policies and procedures regarding people who sleep outside, and Commissioner Fish, you've played a major role in getting us that far. But for me, at least, it fell short of our hopes for a better way forward. This proposal for management of outdoor safe sleeping is the most comprehensive, progressive, and deeply rational proposal that has ever come from City Hall on this issue. And I'm saying that based on my own 10 plus years of experience and that of my more senior legal aid colleagues. There are at least three reasons why Portland should consider this approach. One, from a legal perspective, the writing is on the wall. The Federal Department of Justice has made clear its interest in challenging local ordinances that effectively prohibit homeless individuals from sleeping safely and legally. And as of last September, the Federal Housing Department's application for homeless assistance funding now requires communities to show they're implementing specific strategies to prevent criminalization of homelessness. So Portland can evolve now, or it can face further protracted litigation and risk losing federal funding. Two, our current policy is premised on the assumption that most or all homeless people are sleeping outside by choice, and that by making their behavior criminal, we can both force them to stop sleeping outside and prevent anyone in the future from choosing to sleep outside. And I think that premise is wrong, and I don't think it's working. And I think every day that we operate from that premise is a day in which homeless people in Portland are more isolated, driven into despair, and I mean, Haven said it so well, people are dying. Nobody intends this to happen, but I think we have to try something different. Three, this plan offers a better way forward, and I think it has a real chance of working. To me, the key elements are the reasonableness of the guidelines, the range of options, the willingness to identify and use city land where camping will have lower impact, and the provision of day storage. And to the extent that police will now focus their efforts on criminal activity and set and enforce reasonable expectations, then I think the visible problems about which you all receive so many complaints should diminish. These proposed guidelines are clear and consistent. They will discourage the behaviors that draw complaints. With wholehearted effort by police, city bureaus, and people living on the streets and their allies, this can succeed, and it's certainly worth a try. I know we're short on time, I just wanted to say one more thing. Last year, Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Stephen Bichong was asked to rule yet again on the constitutionality of anti-camping enforcement. And in his decision, he wrote, "The city's anti-camping ordinance is not the solution to this complex problem. Arresting people who are struggling to survive in the streets just because they have no place else to go is not the answer. We must do better than that. But determining the best ways to address this difficult problem is the job of public policymakers, not the courts." So I disagree with Judge Bichong's constitutional analysis.
It was a rare example of deferring to the legislative body.
Precisely.
He's handling another case called Anderson.
But unfortunately, he is correct that the courts are handing the problem back to you, the public policymakers, at least for now. You bear the brunt of public criticism of anything the city does or doesn't do about camping, and I'm very sympathetic to how frustrating that is. At the same time, this is an opportunity to lead out of chaos, to support innovation and smart, realistic community policing, relationship-based, to become the compassionate community we aspire to be. I hope you'll take the opportunity, and really appreciate your giving me a chance to give my perspective.
Monica, a couple questions, and you are consistently have been a voice of reason on the legal side, even when you've been a plaintiff suing the city. And I still have some of the scars from the settlement discussions on Anderson and on church campgrounds. And sometimes the best public policy is made in the context of what is possible at that moment.
Absolutely.
And different circumstances create different moments. You said something interesting about a benefit of guidelines that I don't think gets enough attention. And that is, in effect, it allows us to, it gives us more legal protection, if you will, my words, not yours, to go after behavior that's unacceptable to our community versus status. And I think that's something people need to hear as they weigh this policy. But since you are likely to be someone bringing a lawsuit if that line is crossed, could you amplify your thinking? Would you give us just take a moment to explain why the city might have a freer hand to enforce the law against behavior that is not tolerated, whether you're housed or unhoused, versus status?
Sure. I mean, the courts that have weighed in on this, from the Supreme Court and then many, you know, mostly federal district courts around the country, but state courts, really do make that distinction. And to the extent that, you know, people need a safe place to sleep, and we don't want to make sleeping a criminal activity that's protected by the Eighth Amendment, conduct and behavior is a different matter. And the cases are really all over the place in terms of where they draw that line. But I guess I would just go back to what my clients, people I've spoken to, tell me, which is, you know, if we knew what was expected and we had this sort of clear set of things we need to do, then it would be that much easier to, you know, do what we need to do. So it's sort of practical.
And the other thing I just wanted to note is I have never believed that the vast majority of people outside are sleeping outside by choice. And I know you know that. And the settlement of Anderson presupposed that we would not enforce the camping ban against people in different areas of the city. And we made some artificial distinctions about where we would and would not enforce. But the reality is we took a very light enforcement approach and in some instances stopped enforcing in parts of our city. I don't think that's as fully well understood as it could be. The net effect, but the premise of that was a recognition that there were too many people outside that were sleeping outside, not by choice, and particular emphasis on families with children and vulnerable adults. So I just want to make that qualification because I don't think there has been a huge disagreement on that point. There has been from time to time questions about how far the law would compel us to go, and there is always the question about to what extent can we get community acceptance of what we do, which is a little different than your role. Your job is to convince a court or a judge. Ours is to bring the community along on things that we think are important to us. But I appreciate the hugely constructive role you've played in this issue over many years.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Monica. With your indulgence, I'm going to, I think, move beyond talking about each of our initiatives because, one, the presenters for them are City Hall employees, and we can have other discussions as needed, but I also wanted to move to have George Devendorf come up and talk a little bit about the work that's happening at Sears and the Peace Shelter, if that's okay.
Just before you do that, I know you've had engagement from people who live outside or have previously lived outside. Would you just, for the record, let folks know what that has been?
Thanks, Commissioner. I have probably for 3 months or so now had countless conversations and meetings and visits with people living on the street, some of which to help inform these policies and figure out from a houseless perspective what can work and what wouldn't work, but also just on actual triage. Having given out my cell phone number writ large to the houseless community, I am now tasked at times with trying to clean porta potties and all sorts of activity in camps that we've been working with, which has been a great source of pride for me in getting to know the community. I think it's fair to say, Commissioner, that we each are on a journey on this issue. Some of us have been at it much longer than people like myself have been. And I think it is our own journey that we put at one time or another more into and less into depending on what's going on in our lives. And for me, that journey has really been intensified over the past three months. And so the policies in front of you have been informed not just by the homeless community, but certainly by the homeless community. And while I know many people will find this hard to believe, by neighborhoods as well. And I have been deliberate about reaching out to a sampling of neighborhood residents to try and inform these policies as well. And of course, with providers and outreach workers involved in that mix as well. So rest assured, this wasn't something I cooked up late at night at home. That was part of it. But mostly it was then taking these out and trying to prove the concept with people who actually are experiencing it one way or another. And with that, I'll ask George to come on up. Bob, Lucas, Mark, sorry about that. But I know you'll be on hand for commissioners as needed to discuss each of the initiatives. But before George steps in, let me just say that through the day storage, the one point of contact model, our high-intensity street engagement program, and our new homelessness toolkit, those are components that make this new system possible. Clearly, as Commissioner Novick stated earlier, having more day storage does allow us to be more rigorous about asking people to take their tents down every day and store them, which we also think is a benefit for people on the streets. One point of contact does give the public a faster, easier, way less complicated way of reaching us on these issues and allows for us to not only collect that data but respond fast. A high-intensity street engagement allows us to lead with service before enforcement in virtually every case that we can do that. And these new options, again, if someone chooses none of those options, that's an opportunity for us to assess whether that's a person who is in need of higher-intensity service. And then the homelessness toolkit, which I was going to demo, but I'll show you all later, will be, for now, a web-based platform that is a compendium of all of the information around homelessness in Portland. It has FAQs, statistics, one-pagers on all of the initiatives, a resource guide of shelters, and then how you can help. Probably the most important thing is how you, the individual Portlander, can make a difference on this issue. So we're hoping to go live with that in 2 weeks. We're finishing the content now, and then we'll figure out how to actually create paper versions to get in the hands of people on the streets as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to George to talk about the incredible work the Transition Projects is done in really short order.
Thanks very much, Josh. My name is George Devendorf. I'm the Executive Director of Transition Projects. Thank you for this opportunity to take part in your working session today. So since this City Council declared a state of emergency a few months back, the city has opened two new publicly financed shelters. I'm here today to give you a briefing on how those are going. So together, the Sears facility and the Peace facility have brought 265 more spaces indoors in dry, safe, warm areas than existed prior to your declaration of emergency. And I think that's a tremendous improvement. If there was any question about the demand for that kind of safety off the streets options, I think that was answered within a few days of the opening of both those facilities. We opened Sears in a phased manner, but it quickly reached full capacity. Peace Shelter was full its third night of operation. We know from our own experience managing the city's day center for homeless populations around the city that there is and continues to be a very strong non-seasonal demand for safety off the streets options, and that has not changed. The Sears facility, which we opened on Thanksgiving Day, as I mentioned earlier, is home to 165 individuals now. That's capacity. The center is devoted to women and women with male partners. And on an average night, we'll have 100 women and roughly 65 men that are sheltering in that facility. We're seeing about 34% people of color accessing that facility. To date, I can describe the neighborhood response to the operation of that facility as being strong in a supportive way. So we've seen numerous offers of volunteer support and volunteerism in a number of forms to help support the functioning of that shelter. We've been very pleased with that. We have one neighbor who has been inconvenienced by noise associated with the wheelchair lift of the bus that is necessary in the mornings to help return guests to the downtown area. That's something we're working with city colleagues to try to address. But all things considered, I think the prognosis there is quite good. The second shelter, the Peace Shelter that we established in the building generously provided by the Menasche family, is home to 100 men each night, and we're prioritizing that for men 55 and older, veterans, and those with disabilities. As I mentioned earlier, that's been full since its third night. The neighborhood response thus far in that neighborhood, I'm happy to report. I have nothing to report. It has been all quiet on that front. through hard work of a number of entities, including police and Clean and Safe and others, so far so good. So the bottom line on the city's two newest shelters thus far is that we've had excellent results, and we hope to see that continue. In terms of the outlook, I have to say the outlook is much more unclear, and it's unclear primarily because both of these two new shelters share two fundamental flaws, the first of which is they time out soon. These are temporary emergency shelters, so by May and early June, both will have to be relocated. The second fundamental flaw is that when we budgeted as a city for both those facilities, we were unable to budget the corresponding funding for housing assistance, which would enable folks staying in those shelters to flow through those shelters and secure what we all want them to secure, permanent housing. So in terms of the response and coming up on the next budget cycle, I think the solutions for those two challenges are somewhat clear. The first is, as a community, we need to identify new successor sites for both Sears and for the Peace Shelter. So that's 265 spaces. That could be one place, that could be four places. In any event, that's a tall order. Beyond that, we have the broader community goal identified under a Home for Everyone's plan for the coming year to add an additional 400 on top of that roughly 265 I've just mentioned. So we have our work cut out for us in that regard. But I think we would all agree the last thing we'd want to do is see those people sleeping tonight in Sears and in the Peace Shelter back out on the streets come spring. The second solution really relates to that funding challenge I referenced a minute ago, and that is, as we budget for shelter in the coming year, I think we as a community have to embrace a ratio of roughly a dollar for shelter, a dollar for housing assistance. And to give you an idea of what that looks like, an average shelter in an existing structure like Sears or the Menasche building that can accommodate, say, 100 folks, is going to run about $600,000 over the course of a year. That's a nighttime shelter. What we know from our own experience running shelters and also from our appreciation of how tough the housing environment is and the conditions we're operating under, our sense is that roughly a third of those who stay in that notional 100-person shelter during the course of a year can successfully be moved into permanent housing. And the bill for that, primarily rental assistance, but also some case management support to make that possible, is about $600,000. So as we approach the next year's budgeting cycle, we'd really hope that the powers that be will look at ways to give people who stay in these shelters a fighting chance to make it where they need to go, into permanent housing, and offer that rough dollar handle as a way to assist with budgeting. My concluding thought is, if you allow me to be obvious, is a simple one. The clock is ticking. If we're going to find in any city five, six, seven shelter sites that are going to be viable at the end of the day, our working list probably has to be three or four times that long. And knowing that May and June are not that far away, we're committed to working closely with our colleagues in city government to try to locate those folks, but we're going to need all the help we can get.
The numbers again was 600,000 to operate a 100-person shelter per year, 600,000 also to move a third of those people into permanent housing?
A third of the people who'd stay in that shelter, so that's roughly 166 folks over the course of a year. Thank you all very much.
Yeah, and I wanted to echo the mayor's thanks. TPI, at a moment's notice, has I think pioneered the ability to set these things up in virtually a day, and it's been truly amazing and educational to watch how that happens. I do want everyone to know that we and our team have been at work every single day trying to figure out where we move both shelters. We have a line on several different options that we've been going through, and we'll continue that work so that we can make sure that folks staying both at Sears and at Peace have a landing spot when those shelters go back to their ownership. That is the thing that keeps me up most at night right now, is making sure that we have those and other spaces accommodated for the people that need them, and we'll continue doing that. We, in fact, brought a realtor on staff for a short period of time to sit in our meetings with us to hear firsthand what it is we're looking for, what criteria we need someone to go out and find. And then, of course, the more that we can get the community to step up and offer spaces, the better. And that actually is happening more and more. Mayor and I this morning were approached by... And these don't have to be permanent. In fact, in a lot of ways, they're better when we can use them as a short term, as long as we know that we're looking downfield at where the replacement will be when we need it. So that is both one to reassure you, but also to give a call to action from the community to keep those offers coming in, because we look at every single one very closely and try and make them work.
So on that note, Josh, as we're asking for help from the community, it occurred to me when we're talking about storage and taking down tents that when I go camping and it's been raining that I need to then get my tents out when I get home and spread it out to dry it, because otherwise it's going to go moldy. So perhaps there may be some spaces that would not be suitable for people to inhabit overnight, but that might be suitable for hanging up a bunch of tents to let them dry before the evening. Just something else to ask for.
I really appreciate that, Commissioner, and encourage all of you and everyone here in the audience to keep coming up with those ideas, because we are trying to build out the system, and there are always going to be components of this that we're not thinking through clearly. So I truly appreciate that, and I will say that the most heartwarming thing that has been happening, and the thing that I think keeps us all moving forward, are the community folks who have been stepping up, offering things. As Chief Day mentioned, we were at the Brentwood Darlington Neighborhood Association on Thursday night talking about the spring water, and there was a woman there who is a nurse and has taken it upon herself to create a group of nurses going out and providing triage. Those are the things I think that we as Portlanders know and hold dear as making Portland, Portland, and we're really seeing that now as the community is stepping up and saying, this is all of our problem and we're here to help try and move it forward. So that's been remarkable. We were going to have Joe Zender from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability come up and talk about code work, because in my mind, one of the biggest goals during the state of emergency is to uncover existing barriers and then figure out how we change them permanently, so that we don't have to find ourselves in a position of coming to council and asking to declare a state of emergency every year. I think I'll hold off on having Joe come up and do that, and perhaps ask if he will have time or someone can come next week during Mark's presentation to give a small presentation on that. But there are things that we're already uncovering in siting shelter that have been giant barriers for us that I know we've been trying to address in a holistic, proactive manner to then have the Bureau go through and then go through the process at the Planning Bureau ahead of the end of the state of emergency. So stay tuned for that. And then I think lastly, I'm going to ask Javier to come up and just kind of close this out with a very brief update on where we are as we march towards tomorrow, which is permanent housing. We have a notice of funds available that's been out, and Javier is going to just talk quickly about the process and where we are. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, Mark, you want to come on up as well? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Javier Mena, the Housing Bureau. Before I talk about the NOFA briefly, I want to just, there's questions about the Bureau's investments in 0 to 30 housing, and I just wanted to give you kind of a synopsis of what our investments have been. In terms of the Bureau's portfolio in overall housing, we have about 13,000 units that are restricted as affordable, and 2,112 of those are restricted at 0 to 30, which represents 16% of the portfolio. Currently, we have a pipeline of projects anywhere between awarded to almost coming online. There's about 1,613 units in that pipeline. 1,113 of those are restricted at 0 to 60. Of those, 172 are restricted at 0 to 30, which represents 15% of the pipeline of the current pipeline. In our NOFA, we expect about 700 units to come out online based on that funding. Of those, we are expecting 135 0 to 30 units, which represents about 19% of all those. And that's thanks to a partnership with Home Forward. They are providing 100 Section 8 vouchers for within those projects. Our goal in terms of 0 to 30 funding, understanding that those are the greatest need in terms of population, is to ensure that they are sustainable. And to that degree is what we had in our NOFA. We had listed that all units should be at, all proposals should have at least 5% of those units at 0 to 30. And to whatever degree we can, partner with other resources to increase that number beyond that 5%. In terms of the NOFA, proposals we gave because of the amount and complexity.
And NOFA stands for Notice of Funding Availability.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Because of the complexity of the notice, we allowed for two separate dates for submittals of proposals. The first date was January 11th, and we received 22 proposals, and most of those were for city general fund as well as federal resources and the neighborhood urban renewal areas, the Gateway, Lentz, and Interstate. We received 22 proposals, amounting roughly about a little over $90 million in requests. Today was the deadline for the other proposals for the county, $5 million, as well as the downtown waterfront and North Park blocks. And we don't have the list yet, as they were due today, and our goal would be to get those through the internal analysis within the next month.
Want to have other questions for Josh or?
Yeah, and I want to, if I could, Mayor, I want to tee this up for next week. So, whatever we do to address what's happening on our streets, I believe that we must have a credible plan with the community for a long-term solution. Because no one, and you began your presentation, Josh, by making clear this is not. This is not a preferred strategy. This is born out of necessity. I think we all agree there must be a bridge to a solution. Now, people living on the street are living in the most inhumane conditions, and we know it's also typically the most expensive delivery model that we have. The cost of police officers, emergency rooms, ambulances, the person that misses their medicine and therefore has a long-term hospitalization, all the terrible things that happen to people on the street, most expensive system and the least efficient system we have. We all agree with that. Shelter, George gave us some numbers. If you do the numbers, it's about $12,000 a person for that year. $12,000 is an awful lot of money, and a shelter is not a bridge to anywhere unless, as he suggested, you match the dollars we're spending with a rent voucher, a rent assistance, or something to get someone into housing. Transitional housing is something the city has been very good at, and we work with some great nonprofit providers. And when you go visit our nonprofit providers, you look at the beds they make available for people in recovery or in need of a hand up or a service or above the road, they do a wonderful job. But the street to the shelter to the transition housing has to be, there's a missing piece, and that is the housing, the home that someone can call home for an extended period of time. I have slightly different numbers. We'll clear that discrepancy up from the email I got from the Bureau, but I never disagree publicly with Javier because he's doing God's work. But the bottom line is there's 24,000 people in our community priced out of the marketplace, and that's the macro situation, and we don't dispute those numbers. And we have people on the street who are a subset of that who are really in trouble. And we would have to quadruple 3 to 4 to 5 times our production to keep up with permanent supportive housing units. And let's be clear, we're talking about a home with a service. And if you come to Pete's with me some morning, there's people there that I can introduce you to who without services, they can't stay in their home. And we did a community-wide effort to house one veteran who then gave up his apartment because he wanted to take a trip and something else was going on. We can't get him back in. And he's one of a thousand of stories of people that are struggling. So what I'm getting at is The Housing Bureau is doing amazing work. Commissioner Saltzman is showing great leadership. The council stepped up on an emergency. The mayor has set a big goal for this year of new discretionary dollars, and we should applaud that. But we're losing ground on building the units that people need to move into. And just this past week, the Joyce Hotel announced it was closing. So we're going backwards. We do not have a no net loss policy that we're enforcing. And we're talking about setting aside 5% of units in these new buildings for what we call permanent supportive housing. And I know how hard that is. I know how difficult it is to our providers. I know the money is tight. But I make this point, and it's an obvious point. Today and next week, we're talking about a crisis. And with all due respect, our housing policy is not calibrated to be responsive to people coming through streets and shelter and transitional housing to a home. It's out of whack. And that's not anyone's fault. The multi-program, we have these wonderful tax abatement programs come to council. We celebrate, you know, enlightened developers at 80% MFI. That's $900 for a 500-foot square foot studio. That's not going to solve the problem, the people that we want to get out of the shelters and transitional housing. And so what I hope we do as part of this conversation, because I want the public to believe that there is a pathway off of the street, the shelter, and or else we're lost. I want us to come back and ask some tough questions about the production, because it is uniquely a supply problem. And our vouchers aren't getting us very far anymore because there aren't units available. And rent assistance is harder because even motels are packed. We've got to boost production. Everyone here knows that. That's why everyone is fully engaged. But I don't want us to lose track that there is a divide between our strategies. And I'm going to start voting no on funding things that come to council, not because I don't think the Housing Bureau is doing exceptional work. But I think I'm going to have to just start regularly calling out the fact that we are building housing that doesn't solve this crisis. And we have to figure out how to bridge that divide. And so I hope next week we can hear how the Home for Everyone, which actually has a plan, we don't need to reinvent the plan, and then tell us how we get there. What do we have to do in the next chapter of this response to get there? Because I think we've never had a council top to bottom that's more willing to do something bold.
Thank you. Other comments before we close? Well, I just want to say in closing, Josh, thank you, and Mark and Javier and all the rest of you that are doing this work. Because I think what I know about Portlanders on this subject, really two things. One, we want to live in a beautiful, livable city, and we do. And we have really high expectations of what the quality of life on the streets of our neighborhoods should be. And then secondly, we're caring people. And we have hearts that go out to those that need help. And we have a lot of people on the streets who need our help. And I think everyone sticks together and we make progress on this issue if we do have this kind of plan and if we can show actual tangible progress day to day, week to week, month to month. And having this Home for Everyone consortium, the city and the county and the Housing Authority and Gresham and the nonprofit sector working together is the right model. And I believe that this plan that Josh and others in the community have sketched out waiting for that housing is the right model as well. And we have shown people with our commitment to the Veterans Challenge and our accomplishment of that, and in opening all these shelter beds in the now 4 months of a state of emergency, that it is possible to make progress. So I think you've done us a great service, Josh, by showing us the way forward and by getting a lot of people in the community to step up, including the spontaneous call that you got today with yet another offer of temporary shelter space. So I'm heartened by this, and I'm heartened by the commitment of this whole council and by the YIMBYs, yes, in my backyard, of Multnomah Village, and other good Portlanders who said, I want to help with this, whether it's baking pies or opening the chapel in our church for 13 more men, like First Congregational did. So progress so far, a lot more to come. That's why it's great that we're having these two work sessions in short order. Thank you for those who were able to be here, both as resource people and as citizens on this issue. We'll be back on this subject next week. Thank you very much.
Is that right? And they have that. I mean, the quality usually has that.
That's, you know, and very
cool. I'm Linda. When are the porta potties going to be at 96 individual?
We were looking today to try and place them, and the trick for us is we have to place them on our own land. We've got some algorithms to figure out exactly where, but they're out there working on it, so we have to. Yeah, we're
looking
on.
Forward to it.
Yeah, we have.
You know, I know these are problems. I know we got to. I know it's hard. But
he's actually in charge of everything.
Oh, okay.
So he'll have information, but we're trying to figure that out today.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, as far as I know, that's not the offer they are willing to make in the state, and I'm waiting for a call myself still to get them away.
That's great.
Yeah,
I think we are.